So the first person to come up is Leah Keith. She's a writer and radical feminist activist. She's the author of two novels, as well as Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability, which has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. She's co-author of Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet.
Okay.
Okay, first question. Ready?
Let's have it.
Okay, first question. What is the problem with civilization?
Well.
Wait. So.
What?
Was that laugh because the question's so obvious, or was the laugh because the question's so unthinkable? The former or latter? That's too fast? It's fast? Fast. It's too vast.
Fast. No, it's too big. Well, okay. We might as well just get started, right? We'll lay it all out. Should I go ahead?
Yeah.
You all you had your coffee? You ready? Okay. Well, civilization depends on agriculture. So you have to understand what agriculture is. In very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So it's biotic cleansing. Two problems. The first one, right away, it lets the human population grow to some really big numbers because instead of sharing that land with millions of other creatures, you're only growing humans on it. And the second problem is that it destroys the soil. And soil is the basis of life, well, land life anyway. We owe our entire existence to 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. So except for the last 46 remaining tribes of hunter-gatherers, the human race has now made itself dependent on an activity that is destroying the planet. This is not a plan with a future. It's drawdown. And what you're drawing down is fossil soil. I mean, you're also drawing down fossil water. You're also drawing down species. You're ultimately drawing down entire ecosystems. But the soil is the thing here. And to give you a number, one season of planting your basic row crop, so, you know, rice or corn or wheat, you can run through 2,000 years of soil in one season. There were farms on the first day of the Dust Bowl that lost all of their topsoil in one day. So this is drawdown in just huge measure. So this is Iraq, a picture of Iraq. This is the very first place that agriculture started. I don't think anyone in their right mind could call this the fertile ground, the fertile crescent at this point. And this is Iran, nearby. So 94% of the land has been degraded. Just some random examples. This is Pakistan. This actual spot used to be a deciduous forest 150 years ago. And this is what it looks like now. China. The dust storms from China are so bad now that they are creating asthma in children in Denver, Colorado. The dust comes across the Pacific, hits the mountains, and comes down. That's so much dust. Now, when you destroy soil, you're destroying the basis of life. And Jared Diamond, you know, who won a Pulitzer Prize, he said that agriculture was the biggest mistake the human race has ever made. Toby Hemingway calls sustainable agriculture an oxymoron. And Richard Manning uses exactly the same sentence. And Manning's actually worth quoting. So no biologist, or anyone else for that matter, could design a system of regulations that would make agriculture sustainable. Sustainable agriculture is an oxymoron. It mostly relies on an unnatural system of annual grasses grown in a monoculture, a system that nature does not sustain or even recognize as a natural system. We sustain it with plows, petrochemicals, fences, and subsidies, because there is no other way to sustain it. You could burn those four sentences into your brain. So agriculture is the most destructive thing that people have done to the planet. I'm going to repeat that. Agriculture is the single most destructive human activity. So remember what agriculture is. You pull down the forest, you plow up the prairie, you drain the wetland. You destroy the living communities that our planet would naturally create. And what used to be habitat for millions of creatures, doing that basic work of life, it turns into salt and dust. Agriculture is carnivorous. What it eats is entire ecosystems, and that is what it has done around the globe. So to state the obvious, no culture that is destroying the basis of life itself can be called sustainable. I mean, really, it can only be called insane. So agriculture has run through every continent, well, all of them except Antarctica, but that's okay. We're going to get that one with global warming. Actually, agriculture marks the beginning of global warming. It's also the beginning of militarism, and it depends upon slavery. In the 7 centers where agriculture began, human societies follow the same pattern, and that's called civilization. To use a really basic definition, that just means life in cities. Now, a hint, when I say civilization, that's not a good thing. It's people living in settlements that are big enough that they require the importation of resources. They've used up what the land can give them. They need more. So they always have to go out and get whatever it is they need, food, water, energy, because they've used up their own. So by definition, they've overshot their land base. So this is the pattern of civilization everywhere. There's a bloated power center, and then it's surrounded by conquered colonies, and that from which the power center takes what it wants. So can you find the psychopath in this picture? Agricultural societies end up militarized, and they always do, and it's for three reasons. The first being that agriculture creates a surplus, and if it can be stored, it can be stolen. Somebody has to guard it. Those people are called soldiers. Second problem is imperialism. Agriculture is essentially a war against the natural world. It's inherently destructive, and eventually the agriculturists use up what they have, their soil, their trees, their water. They've got to go out and get it somewhere else, but people do not willingly give up their land, their water, their trees. The power center needs those things, so there's an entire class of people whose job is to go out and get the stuff that the power center needs. Agriculture makes that possible. It also makes it inevitable. And problem number three, of course, is slavery. So this is Mesopotamia. Some of those resources are, in fact, other human beings. Agriculture is also backbreaking labor. For anyone to have leisure, there needs to be slaves. So we've lost the cultural memory of this because we've been using fossil fuel to do that labor for the last, 100, 150 years. But by the year 1800, fully three-quarters of people on the planet were in some form of indenture, slavery, or serfdom, three-quarters. That's how much labor it takes to do this. And the only reason we've forgotten that is because we're using machines now. But I guarantee you when the fossil fuel runs out, we're going to remember exactly how much labor is involved. So once you have huge numbers of the population in slavery, you need someone to keep them there, and that would be the soldiers. And this is a cycle we've been on for 10,000 years. This picture is an iconic image that was used by the abolition movement, and this is a drawing that was made by a slaver to give other slavers an instruction on how to pack the maximum number of human beings into the hull of a ship. And it's actually an interesting history here. This was, as far as anybody knows, it was the first time that an image was used by the sort of fledgling mass media in the service of a movement for social change. And the idea was that this picture was so horrifying that people would be converted to the cause. So if you were an abolitionist, they printed thousands of these things. Your job was to put it everywhere in public that you could think of. And indeed, it was very effective. There's all kinds of first-person accounts of people who remember the first time they saw this, and they were, in fact, converted to become abolitionists. I actually remember the first time I saw this. I was 12 or 13 in history class. We were shown this picture, and I still remember the horror, that it instilled in me. So anyway, that's that picture. So this is why the agriculturalists will always win, at least short term. If you're willing to destroy your forest, you're going to win against the people who aren't willing to destroy theirs. And it takes 600 old-growth trees to make one of these ships. So eventually, you're going to have to conquer the people who aren't willing to destroy theirs so you can take their trees, too. So that's the last 10,000 years in two or three sentences. This is the St. Croix River in Canada, in case you don't believe me. The brown, that is the section of the river that goes through the agricultural areas, and it's brown with soil. The blue is the part of the river that still goes through some intact forest, and it's blue because there's no soil in it. So there's a perfect illustration of this. So there aren't any new continents. Atlantis is not waiting to be discovered outside of your past life regressions. By the year 1950, this planet was out of topsoil. What happened next was the Green Revolution, and that was based on fossil fuel. So at this point, if you're eating grain, you're eating oil on a stalk. You're not just eating fossil soil, you're eating fossil fuel. It takes somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 tons of TNT per acre for the average American farm. Iowa alone uses the energy equivalent of 4,000 Nagasaki bombs every year. That's how much energy goes into this. And when I talk about this as a war against the planet, this is not a metaphor. It's quite real. So the very creation myth of Western civilization says what? Dominate, conquer, go forth and multiply. No hunter-gatherer is told by God to willfully overshoot the land base. And no marginally rational person would listen to such a God. But that is what we are up against. And we're going to have to say this out loud. This is a culture of profound entitlement based on a masculine violation imperative. That imperative includes violating the boundaries of women and children, the boundaries of rivers and forests, the DNA of salmon, coming soon to a store near you, transgenic salmon, and ultimately the integrity of the atom itself. The ruling religion of this planet is called patriarchy. We will not save life on Earth until we dismantle masculinity. You will be punished for saying that out loud, but we've got to gather up our courage and do it anyway, because our planet really is at stake.
So before we go on, can you clarify something about the masculinity? Can you make clear that you're not talking about...
Why don't you make it clear?
Well,
you got something in mind.
Well, just that, like you said yesterday at the Occupy, that when you talk about the masculine imperative violet, you're not talking about biology.
No. Patriarchy takes a group of people who are biologically male, turns them into a social class of people called men through socialization to this masculinity. So it's got nothing to do with biologically what you are or aren't. This is a political arrangement. It's not natural. It was not created by God. It's a corrupt and brutal arrangement of power is what it is. So does that do it for you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great.
Well, any chance to sort of shoot down the Richard Dawkins selfish gene idea?
No, I'm there. Yeah.
Anyway, so what do we need?
Well, if this is a war, we need a resistance movement. Two of my favorite people from history, Christabel Pankhurst. We know that relying solely on argument, we wandered for 40 years politically in the wilderness. We know that arguments are not enough and that political force is necessary. And then, of course, Frederick Douglass. Power could seize nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. So if this is a war, we need a resistance movement. And the first question, do you think this war is a metaphor, or is it real? Now, there's a substantial number of people on the left who would say, well, not only is this a metaphor, but I'm using the wrong metaphor. There's no enemy. There's no us and them. There's only well-meaning, if wounded, people. Well, that cuts right to the main division between liberals and radicals. So you've heard of speed dating. This is speed revolution. Okay, so real quick. The liberals believe that society is made up of individuals. And individualism is so sacrosanct that in this view, being identified as a member of a group or class, that's the insult. On the radical side, it's totally different. And it was really Karl Marx that we owe this debt to Karl Marx, whether we're Marxists or not. He's the one who figured this out, that society is not made up of individuals. It's made up of classes of people. And originally that was economic class in his vision, but any group or caste. Okay, and some of those groups have power over other groups. So this is not an individual condition. Being a member of a group is not any kind of an affront, far from it. Identifying with that group of people is the first step toward political consciousness and ultimately effective action. You make common cause with the people who share your condition. And the other big division is on the nature of social reality. So liberalism is idealist, and what that means is, for them, social reality is made up of ideas, of attitudes, and therefore social change happens through rational argument and education. Now, on the radical side, materialism. And that means that society is organized by concrete systems of power. Okay, it's not thoughts and ideas. It's material conditions, material institutions. So for radicals, the solution to oppression is to take those systems apart brick by brick. The liberals will say we have to educate, educate, educate. And the radicals will say, no, actually, we have to stop them. So if you remove power from the equation, which is what liberalism does, oppression looks voluntary, which erases the fact that it's social subordination. So here we have Harriet Tubman. I freed hundreds of slaves, and I could have freed hundreds more if they had but known they were slaves, which is a very poignant way to say the same thing. People withstand oppression using three psychological methods: denial, accommodation, consent. Anyone on the receiving end of domination learns early in life. You stay in line or you risk the consequences, and those consequences only have to be applied once in a while to be effective. From that point forward, the traumatized psyche will police itself. So, if they had known, but they were slaves. Now, any show of resistance is met with a continuum that starts with derision. It ends with, out-and-out violence. But resistance does happen somehow. People will insist on their humanity. So here's Tank Man, saying what we should all be saying over my dead body. Now, once some understanding of oppression is gained, most people are called to action. And I got to say, I think that's our hardest job as radicals, is breaking through that denial, the accommodation, and consent. So we've got some categories of response. I say there were four broad categories: legal remedies, direct action, withdrawal, and spirituality. Now, these categories can overlap in ways that are crucial to resistance movements. All of them can be diversions that dead end. None of them are definitively liberal or radical in themselves. And if you walk away with nothing else from this talk, that's what I want you to remember. All four of these categories have key strategic strengths for resistance movements, but we have to understand them strategically. So again, this is the realization that radicalism will bring you, and it's that social change requires force. Why? Because it's not a mistake out of which the powerful can be educated. Now, don't misunderstand me, please. When I say force, that does not have to mean violence. Okay, this is not about violence versus nonviolence. Whether to wage your struggle using violent or nonviolent tactics, it's a decision that comes much later. Nonviolence is a very elegant political tactic when understood and used correctly. This is only to recognize that power is not a mistake, it's not a misunderstanding, it's not a disagreement. And that means that justice is not won by rational argument, by personal transformation, or by spiritual epiphany. It's won by taking power away from the powerful and then dismantling their institutions. So again, these are our four categories. So first is the legal one. This kind of makes sense. The most activist groups sort of naturally are drawn to the legal arena, and that's for very good reason. As Catherine MacKinnon says, law organizes power. The trick is we need to do this as radicals. And that means asking the question, does this initiative redefine power? Not just who's at the top of the pyramid. Does it take away the rights of the oppressors and reestablish the rights of the dispossessed? Does it let people control the material conditions of their lives? Number two is direct action. So other activists will bypass that legal arena altogether, and they go right for other ways to apply pressure. And, you know, great example from history, the Montgomery bus boycott. Okay, this wasn't it wasn't particularly a legal struggle. They used their economic power. They boycotted the bus for 18 months until the bus company had to cry uncle. So you apply economic pressure, other kinds of pressure that can be applied, not necessarily legal pressure. Another good example would be your basic insurrection. So direct action can cover a lot of ground here. But as with the legal remedies, the direct action can be anywhere from liberal to downright revolutionary. Now, the third category is withdrawal. The main difference between withdrawal as a successful strategy and withdrawal as a failed strategy is whether the withdrawal is seen as adequate in itself or whether it's linked to political resistance. Now, this difference hinges exactly on that distinction between liberal and radical. Issues of identification and loyalty, those are crucial to resistance movements. You got to build that class consciousness, but this alone is not enough. The withdrawal has got to go beyond the intellectual, the emotional, the spiritual. It's got to include a goal of actually winning justice. Withdrawal may give solace, but ultimately it will change nothing. Living in a rarefied bubble world of the converted is a very poor substitute for freedom, and it will not save our planet. So this is Gene Sharp, who I think everybody should read right away. He's just an amazing theorist on nonviolent direct action. He's been responsible for revolutions all over the world. He's an amazing human being. Anyway, the people that he calls withdrawalists, I call utopian, that I call withdrawalists, he calls utopians. Utopians are especially sensitive to the evils of the world, and craving certainty, purity, and completeness, they firmly reject the evil as totally as possible, wishing to avoid any compromises with them. They await a new world, which is to come into being by an act of God, a change in the human spirit, by autonomous changes in economic conditions, or by a deep, spontaneous social upheaval, all beyond deliberate human control. The most serious weakness of this response to the problem of this world is not the broad vision or the commitment of the people who believe in it. The weakness is that these believers have no effective way to reach the society of their dreams. Well, that about sums up my youth. I've heard the phrase secular millennialism, and that's exactly what Sharp is getting at. The left has these vague notions that our actions will inspire others, and then even more vaguely, these will somehow accumulate into a societal transformation or maybe kick off a spontaneous insurrection. There's the nonviolent version. That usually includes, you know, lifestyle choices like diet, or it could be militant action like the Weather Underground. But those are the two poles of secular millennialism. Change will happen because it must, because either that great turning narrative of progress says that it must, or because the fires of our righteous rage will make it be so. But given that victory is not in fact inevitable, we would be well advised to understand the basic principle of resistance. Dislodging injustice requires, in the words of Andrea Dworkin, organized political resistance. So our final category, spirituality. A withdrawalist stance is an answer to despair. but it is an answer that only relies on faith. Okay, so it's not a strategy, which is to say it's an emotional solution. It's not a material solution. And this merges into millenarianism. So this is any religious movement that predicts the collapse of the world order, replaced by this millennium, the period of justice or equality, salvation. There's a lot of examples from history of desperate people taking this up. I highly recommend reading up on it. Much of the left has been infected with some version of this, so we're going to meditate to stop global warming, we're going to orgasm our way to peace, and if all else fails, which it will, there's always December 2012. divine intervention has never yet stopped a system of unjust power across the entire sweep of human history. That is never. Material help from some other realm of existence is a very bad strategy. To date, it has been a complete failure. This is not in any way to dismiss the role of spirituality in a true culture of resistance. Spirituality can give people the courage, the endurance, the dignity that we need under oppressive conditions. It can also provide norms of behavior that help hold communities together under some really rough situations. But faith is not a political strategy. The only miracle we're going to get is us. So we're going to put all this together now in an example from history, and this is the Irish struggle for independence. Now, the Irish had endured English occupation for 800 years with the usual array of horrors. In 1880, there's a new movement that's called the Gaelic Revival. And this is a movement that sought to bring cultural pride and self-respect to the Irish as Irish. So teaching the language that was going extinct, theater, poetry, music, dance, these were all really ancient traditions in Ireland. So they revive all this, and then there's also groups like the Gaelic Athletic Association. So they're running around playing games? Well, yes, but they're also learning something very important. They're learning how to work as a team. They're learning about basic military strategy, and they're learning to value physical fitness. The Gaelic Athletic Association goes on to become the seed for the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and that is what ultimately becomes the IRA, the original IRA, which goes on to wage the armed struggle.
Which is why at the beginning of that great movie...
I'm about to say that. You can say it, though.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Please.
Which is why at the beginning of the great movie, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, they're playing...
They're doing exactly this.
Yeah, it's like, why the hell are they starting the movie with this?
Running around on a team. And they got the history exactly right. This is where it began, was with this. So the Gaelic Revival then segues right into the first, sort of the first round of the struggle, and that's called the Land War. Now, I love the language on this poster. Redeem your character now. I don't know if you can all read that. It's just great stuff. These two guys, Parnell and Dillon, were very involved. They had been arrested, and this is the attempt to get them out of jail by engaging in a rent strike. So, the man who pays rent will be looked upon as a traitor to his country and a disgrace to his class. Don't you have, a list of people you want to say this to? Redeem your character now. And at the bottom, the really great part, there's this little bit about security culture. Avoid the police and listen not to spying and deluding bailiffs. They will lie to you, right? I would pay any money for an original one of these. I just love this. Anyway, the land war, this is a struggle to win back the land. And there's all this just mass starvation happening across Ireland. Tremendously successful. By the year 1914, 90% of the land was once again in the hands of the small to medium-sized farmers. And they did that almost entirely using nonviolence. There were very, very few incidences of violence in this. So this is the pattern. You got the culture of resistance, and then they start winning these sort of smaller goals, like the land war. And from there, it leads into the actual the armed resistance. But it all starts with the Gaelic Revival, with that culture of resistance. So understand, nobody said, well, we'll just put on some nice plays, and we'll sing some of our own songs, and the English will go away. Nobody said, well, let's just change our consciousness. We don't need to change this corrupt and brutal arrangement of power. No, if we just love each other enough, that'll magically do the trick. No one suggested that withdrawal alone would be a sufficient strategy. The Irish culture of resistance believed in resistance. It prepared for resistance. It supported the resistance. And ultimately, it planned for its success. They did support for political prisoners. They provided all kinds of material support for families that were in distress, especially if the breadwinner was in jail. Lots of stuff about hungry children, school children. They got all kinds of money for that. They set up their own court system to settle disputes, and they ultimately went on to wage both violent and nonviolent struggle against the English occupation. Now, we could follow a very similar trajectory in a lot of political movements. So the Harlem Renaissance and the Pullman Porters. I mean, it's the same kind of bridge between slavery and the civil rights movement. The part of withdrawal that's necessary is breaking through that psychology of the oppressed, so the accommodation, the denial, the consent. That's crucial. Developing self-respect, loyalty to your own people, that class consciousness, it's crucial, but it's not enough. So it's necessary but not sufficient. So why is so much of the left insisting on these withdrawalist strategies, personal solutions, and this vague millenarianism in the back as a fallback, especially when the entire planet is at stake? We need a little more history here. My ex says that history is same characters, different costumes, and we are about to find out exactly how right she is. So, first I want to add the white person apology. This next section is just entirely about European history. The reason I'm talking about this is not because I think Europe is so great. It's because, you know, even in the current day, the left in this country is, the white people are still hegemonic, control way more of the norms of behavior and whatnot. So no matter what culture of resistance you come from, you're going to be up against these same problems that have come through from European history. So that's why I think it's important to talk about this. Okay, so there's a long history in Europe of political movements and dissenting groups. Some are more religious, some are more utopian. You can actually go back to ancient Greece if you want to pick up from there, but we don't have time for all that. We're going to start with the Romantic movement. Now, this is an artistic movement that begins in the second half of the 18th century in Western Europe. It's at least partly a reaction to the Age of Enlightenment, which valued rationality. And there's this ascendancy of science that's beginning right now, and the mechanistic reduction of the cosmos to a machine. Up until that point, the leading image of the how people thought about the cosmos or the Earth, it was a living body. And with the age of rationality, the whole universe is seen as clockwork that people can figure out and take apart. So the whole image shifts to be this machine. And as industrial revolution gains strength, of course, the commons are destroyed. So the wetlands, the rivers, the forests, it all falls. And of course, people are pushed off into just, you know, terrible conditions in cities, and it's just the same story everywhere. So there's three themes in the Romantic movement. The evocation of the past, there's the heroic isolation of the individual, and respect for wild nature. Now, Germany in particular produces a lot of the art and the music and whatnot of this movement, and it joins forces with another sort of historical trend, which is nationalism, that's just starting to evolve. And though both of those put together, you get this new interest in folk culture, and there's this longing for a connection to the ancient land. And out of this comes another movement, what's called the Lebensreform movement. Now, this is a social movement that emphasized physical fitness and natural health. Any of this sound a wee bit familiar? These are all variations on this main theme of connecting with nature. So, and there's all these political and lifestyle components that come with it. So, paganism, feminism, psychoanalysis, pacifism, Eastern religion. Everybody from Isadora Duncan to Leon Trotsky to Franz Kafka passes through this world at some point. Gandhi's a big fan of the Lebensreform. He sets up a nature cure clinic in India. So a lot of this goes east, and what comes back the other way is Buddhism, Hinduism, meditation, yoga. And so the Lebensreform, they create their own schools, their own clinics, intentional communities. This is Ascona in Switzerland. This was like the Big Sur of the age, the Esalen Institute. Some of the Lebensreform inherits, so there's school teachers in Berlin in the city, and they're all big into hiking, getting out into nature. So they start taking their students out for these hikes, and the hikes extend into weekends. The weekends start to become a lifestyle because the teenagers start to coalesce into their own subculture. And now we come to the Wandervogel. You know the drill, ignorant of history, condemned to repeat it. So they embrace the natural, the rural, the emotional, the spontaneous. The Wandervogel was actually the origin of the youth hostel movement because they are wandering around the German countryside taking over abandoned buildings. This literally becomes the infrastructure for the youth hostel movement. They sing folk songs, they experiment with fasting and raw food and vegetarianism, and they embrace ecological ideas. This is all before the year 1900. Okay? They are the anarchist vegan squatters of the age. The connections between the Lebensreform, the Wandervogel youth, and the 1960s counterculture in this country are startlingly direct. These two painters set the artistic style. So this is this guy, Gustav Grasser, and then this, he has one name, Fidus. And this gets transplanted whole into the 1960s. I mean, you would think you were looking at record album covers from 1968. You're not. This is before 1900. What I've got up there with the red arrow is a peace sign. They're already using the peace sign. So Gustav Grasser is a mentor to Hermann Hesse, who he writes in the 1920s, but of course his books are taken up by the beatniks and they sell by the millions in the 1960s. And that's just one example. Okay, there's a direct line of cultural continuity from the von der Vogel right on through to the 1960s. Some of these guys are they're pacifists and they're draft resistors in World War I in Germany. So they emigrate to the United States to escape the draft. Well, where do they go? You're not going to do this in Minnesota. They settle in California. Here's the whole book about them. And they start attracting followers. They write a number of books themselves, and some of these get taken up directly by in the Haight-Ashbury by the hippies. They're about fasting and sunbathing and vegetarianism. Okay, this unbroken line of cultural continuity. What we have is an alternative culture, right? What we need is a culture of resistance. So what's the difference? I started making this chart, which you'll see in bigger in a minute, and suddenly I had like the light bulb moment, because I realized I was looking at a culture that was created by the adolescent brain. In the year 1911 in Germany, there were more teenagers than there ever would be again. The von der Vogel gets transplanted to the U.S. It goes dormant for about 50 years, starts to pick up speed again with the beatniks. But what happens in 1960? It's another bumper crop of teenagers. And of course this is what they're attracted to. It's a culture created by people exactly like them. Now, I've been everywhere across the spectrum, sometimes all at once. Okay, the first difference between the alternative and the oppositional culture, this is a split to the root between the romantics and the resistance. It's a split that's been present for centuries. They both start with a rejection of some part of the social order, but they identify their enemy differently, and from there they head in opposite directions. So the first is really obvious. Are you apathetic to political engagement, or do you consciously embrace resistance? That would be pretty key. Now, the focus on individual change, that's a hallmark of liberalism. Only individuals can change. So individuals are then the only worthy project for change. So, precious me. And I'm sorry to be so snide, but I do find these people unbearable. Injustice becomes an excuse for narcissism. Now, my favorite is this idea of personal example as some kind of activism. And this is where you get all this emphasis on things like, your personal carbon footprint. And am I the only one who's noticed when you are talking about carbon footprint, that is the only time that men try to prove they're smaller? Yeah, all right. So we're going to talk about example as a political strategy.
Just a second. It's pretty interesting. That was a very feminine laugh from the audience. Sort of a soprano laugh.
So we're going to take down example as a political strategy. Now, by their nature, agricultural societies are imperialist. They're based on drawdown. Civilization follows that same pattern of conquering the region, all the outlying regions, over and over for 10,000 years. Those imperialistic cultures have invaded the territory of neighboring indigenous peoples. And some of those indigenous embody values that everyone in this room holds dear. They're sustainable, egalitarian, peaceful cultures. And in all that time, over all those invasions, the face-to-face example of a sustainable, egalitarian culture has never once changed the invading culture. It has never once brought on an epiphany in the invaders. That's never once in 10,000 years. Okay? Personal example does not work. The dominant culture will not change because it beholds the beautiful nonviolent values that we hold in our hearts, and it will not change because it sees our life-affirming free-range compost piles. There are no exceptions. This doesn't work. We're going to have to give this one up. Now, the farthest extreme of individualism is where personal lifestyle becomes personal purity, and identity itself is declared some kind of political act. And this is where subcultures start to feel like cults. But any strategy based on individual change is doomed to fail because social subordination is not an individual condition. It's a class condition. It's a group condition. And it will only change by group effort. So the defining characteristic of an oppositional culture, on the other hand, is that it consciously claims to be that cradle of resistance. Where the alternative culture exists to create personal change, the oppositional culture exists to nurture a serious movement for political transformation. It understands that concrete systems of power have to be dismantled and that such a project will require tremendous courage, commitment, risk, and potential loss of life. But that focus on the individual and is where liberalism and adolescence dovetail perfectly. So the adolescent brain is still under construction. And basically the areas of the brain that are responsible for impulse control, for long-range planning, for considering consequences, and for managing emotional states, which is mostly your frontal lobes, those go offline when you're a teenager. Also, our sense of time isn't actually developed fully until we're 21 years old. So adolescents cannot understand cause and effect, and they can't do long-range planning. They don't understand the consequences. Yes?
This reminds me of just one of my favorite examples from my brother. When he was about 15 or 16, his shoes were muddy, and then he walked into the living room and started cleaning the mud off his shoes. And my mom came in and said, "Why are you cleaning the mud off your shoes in the living room?" And he said, "Oh, you're right.
It's just not working." Yeah, yeah. Do you want to tell that other story? About what you did in your car when you ran that red light?
I don't know what you're talking about.
When you ran from the police in your car? You would never do that now.
Oh, yeah.
It's just such a teenage thing to do.
There was a sign that said no left turn because it was onto a one-way street, and it didn't say no U-turn. So I made a U-turn there. Unfortunately, there was a cop two cars behind me.
He's 16, okay.
Yeah,
he's a teenager.
And the cop pointed at me and pointed to the side of the road, and so I did what any 16-year-old would do, which is accelerate. I then turned left at the first corner, turned right at the next one, turned left at the next one, went into an apartment building and hid.
Hid.
The thing is, it worked.
Yeah, it did. So, adolescents clearly cannot understand cause and effect, long-range consequences, and they're prone to risk-taking and impulsive behavior. Anger and overall emotional intensity. I think we all remember what this was like. And adolescence is that phase of life when that question of, you know, who am I, takes on this tremendous importance. There's nothing wrong with that. It's your job when you're a teenager. You've got to figure out who you are. The problem is that when you have a culture that's created by teenagers as opposed to a true culture of resistance. So what happens? Well, the idea of authority is rejected outright, whereas a serious resistance movement would be training people for appropriate leadership roles in the movement. For the alternative culture, the enemy is seen as a constraining set of values. Over on the oppositional side, it's not. It's material conditions. It's, you know, concrete systems of power. And this, their main program on the alternative side is it's really about attacking boundaries rather than injustice. And this has had serious consequences on the left. The creators of this counterculture were not just any teenagers. They were privileged and they were male. And this has spelled disaster for women and girls. I mean, these are the boys who brought us porn culture, and we are now collectively saturated in sexual sadism. Alienation may be a good place to start, but you can't stop there. Alienated individuals cannot build loyalty or solidarity. By definition, they're alienated. Politics is always a group project, and you do have to play well with others to make it work.
I want to also bring up that this goes way back, as you know, way back before the Vondervogel, that when I was actually late teen, early 20s, I got very interested in the cynics, capital C cynic philosophers. You know, Diogenes is pretty interesting because he said that the happiest day of his life was when he saw that a dog drinking out of a stream, because then he wouldn't have to carry a cup anymore. They believed that possessions possess you, which is pretty smart. I like all that. But they also believed in boundary breaking for the sake of boundary breaking. They would masturbate or have sex in public for the sake of breaking boundaries. That's the only reason. And they would beg, and then if somebody gave them money, they would insult them. And this is the unbroken continuity to today. There's an anarchist website called Fuck for Forests that is all about, they say, and it's pretty funny and disgusting because they went to an anarchist conference and broke up the anarchist conference by having sex in the aisle. And then complained when people wanted them to stop, and they said, "How can you have an anarchist conference with rules?" And so this was boundary violation for the sake of boundary violation. Goes straight back
to the
2,000 years to the cynics.
So only a teenager could really think that the world revolves around how they feel. That adolescent concern of identity, of who I am, takes on this political importance that outweighs what one might actually do. So the counterculture is a product of this psychology, and that's where it's been permanently stuck. The concerns of adolescence, its gifts and its shortcomings, are the framework for the entire alternative culture. So those community norms and those habits of behavior, they've become accepted across the left in what Theodore Roszak called a progressive adolescentization of dissenting thought and culture. He said that in 1968. So this is the model of the Wandervogel. Our lack of purpose is our strength. Yeah, no joke. Same characters, different costumes. 60 years later, you got Abbie Hoffman. Revolution for the hell of it. Now, on the positive side, the gifts of youth are that incredible moral vigor, that fearless courage, the passion, the idealism. Every movement needs an infusion of those regularly, every movement. Because I've got to tell you, by the time you're middle-aged, it's wearing off. But the alternative culture stops there. It stops that vigor from effective action. And when you can't fight power, all you can fight is each other. And this is what Florence Kennedy called horizontal hostility. So this can be a feeding frenzy of ugly gossip and character assassination. In more militant groups, it takes the form of paranoid accusations. And in the worst instances of groups that encourage that kind of macho posturing, it ends with men shooting each other. Ultimately, it's caused by fighting horizontally rather than vertically. So in the first panel, king's got all the power, the people are all sad, bad situation. The second, the people realize they can fight, so they're making solidarity and they're fighting up. The third panel, they've closed that off as an option. They don't want to do resistance, they don't believe in it. All they can fight is each other. And again, you've got this very happy king on the top of it all. So if the only thing we can change is ourselves, or if the best tactic for social change are lifestyle choices, then indeed critiquing the minutia of people's personal lives is going to seem like a righteous activity. But if it feels like you're back in junior high school, there is a reason.
I want to say one more thing,
yeah,
too, which is also Judith Herman talks about how adult survivors of childhood abuse end up hating the bystander more than they end up hating the perpetrator, because the bystander is safe. And the same thing has happened here, that it's much safer to attack horizontally. That's not scary, because if you attack up, the king could very well cut off your head.
Mm-hmm.
And if you attack your neighbor, they're just going to gossip back about you or whatever. So there's also a level, there's all this, and there's also just straight fear.
Right. So that's what we're up against. So finally, the Romantic movement and the Wandervogel, they created an image of the peasant as an authentic, anti-rational symbol, close to nature. And this is where we get the peasant blouses, which are still with us. Now, their idea of a peasant actually had nothing to do with actual peasants, who did exist in Germany at the time and could have used some solidarity. Now, when the Wandervogel got transplanted to the United States, well, there aren't any peasants, so two groups get pressed into service and continue to be used by the privileged for their own psychological needs. And right now, that's mostly African Americans and or Native Americans who get cast as emotional, childlike, natural, authentic. Do I really need to explain what's wrong with this picture? I hope not. So on the alternative side, cultural appropriation is the norm. On the oppositional side, that would be completely unacceptable. But protecting ceremonies from abuse and exploitation is one really obvious task. So let me tell you how this works in successful resistance movements. The people over 30 have laid a lot of the groundwork, often for a generation or two. In the civil rights movement, you had the Harlem Renaissance and then the Pullman Porters. And they're the bridge between the civil rights movement, from slavery to the civil rights movement. They took a culture of survival, and they start to transform it into a culture of resistance. And what they're accumulating is self-respect, cultural pride, political experience, and material resources. All four of those are necessary. So it's like you're laying up the firewood, and someone has to light the match. So then you get the four college students who sit down at lunch counters and kick the whole thing off. The original four who started this, they were all 18-year-old college freshmen. And 9 months before Rosa Parks, on March 2nd, 1955, Claudette Colvin refused to give up her seat on the bus to a white man. She was dragged from the bus by the police. She was 15 years old. A few months later, Mary Louise Smith did the same thing. She was 18 years old. Finally, December 1st, you get Rosa Parks. So the third time was the charm. But the number of teenagers involved is never a coincidence. Okay, it's always the young who strike that match. You get even younger kids. So this is the children's crusade. The world was horrified by these pictures. I mean, the idea that you would turn a fire hose on a 12-year-old. And then there were even younger kids. So this is little Ruby Bridges single-handedly desegregating the Louisiana public school system. We really have no right to be standing on the sides or wringing our hands about how we can't do anything when a 6-year-old can produce this kind of courage. Let's hear it for Ruby. She actually wrote a memoir. You should read it. It's an astounding story about what this was like to be this young and to be doing this every day. The British suffragettes follow a very similar pattern. There's 3 generations of people who are fighting for abolition, for labor, for women's suffrage. Emmeline Pankhurst is one of the leaders of the movement. She had Uncle Tom's Cabin read to her as a bedtime story. She wrote, "Young as I was, I could not have been older than 5 years old. I knew perfectly well the meaning of the words slavery and emancipation." Now, that's a culture of resistance. In turn, her daughters, Christabel and Sylvia, they grow up in the struggle. They used to cry because they were too young to go to meetings. They wanted to go so bad. At one point, young Christabel says to her mom, "How long you women have been trying for the vote. For my part, I mean to get it." And her mother is actually quite afraid of her daughter's courage and their fearlessness. And she writes in her journal, "Was there a difference between trying for the vote and actually winning the vote?" And she realizes that if she can bring together the experience of the older women with that passion and that fearless idealism of the young, that she could create a movement that would actually do it. She was absolutely right. And so she created the Women's Social and Political Union, the WSPU. They did massive, relentless civil disobedience, including hunger strikes in prison. They were tortured in prison. The government passed a law specifically so that they could be tortured. It even used the female pronoun, so the prisoner she, just in case anybody was, unclear on the concept. So when the civil disobedience stopped working, Christabel escalated the troops to arson. So they blew up mailboxes, golf courses, historic buildings, railway stations. And I want to point out they did this, they had to wear long skirts. The dress reform movement hadn't gotten very far. So they're wearing 40 pounds of skirting, and they're wearing corsets. They couldn't breathe. And they're running through fields in the middle of the night being chased by police carrying bombs. And they did it. Scaling walls and everything. Gandhi was actually a big fan. He subscribed to 3 different British newspapers so he could keep up on their actions. The Pankhursts were brilliant strategists, and they were loved by their movement. So here's Emmeline. There's actually really old recordings where you can hear her give speeches. The left now has a terrible tendency to cannibalize its leaders. That was not always the case. People went to extraordinary lengths to protect the Pankhursts from jail. So this has everything to do with those cultural norms created by the teenagers. There's this knee-jerk reaction now against all authority, but that has not always been true. So resistance movements, they always need a constant infusion of the courage and the idealism from the young. The resistance movements don't get anywhere without that. But they also need the experience, the stability, and the material resources combined with the long-range planning that adults are capable of. And my real take-home point here is that successful resistance movements are always multi-generational. Breaking the natural bonds between the young and the old, it means that political wisdom never accumulates. And what it means now, especially, is that the young aren't socialized into a culture of resistance. They're being socialized instead into this pretty horrifying popular culture created by corporate America, which has everything to gain by destroying our capacity for community, never mind our capacity for resistance. So a few simple questions. Are we after shock value, or are we after justice? Is the problem a constraining set of values, or an oppressive set of material conditions? Are we content to coexist alongside injustice and all its horrors, no matter how repelled we are by those horrors? And is the self really an appropriate long-term project? Or can we move on to something a little bit bigger now? Because another 200 species went extinct today, and they were my kin. You have a question for me.
What do we need? Okay, I know. I was just thinking. So what do we need?
Redeem your character now. We need organized political resistance. The task of an activist is not to navigate around systems of oppression with as much personal integrity as possible. It's to dismantle those systems. Consumer choices, spiritual choices, lifestyle choices, those are not going to dismantle global arrangements of power, and that's the problem. To get to a real resistance, we need a culture of resistance. Instead, we have the permaculture wing, we have the transition towners, the voluntary simplicity people. I call them the Oinbees. only in my backyard. Taken as a whole, and I know there are some exceptions, but taken as a whole, they dismiss political action as either impractical or impossible. And this is a very bad habit that the left is going to have to break. We are the people who should be shouting from every street corner and every rooftop that not only is resistance possible, failure is impossible given what's at stake. So let's pretend that we're in Nazi-occupied France or U.S.-occupied Vietnam or even U.S.-occupied North America, for that matter. Would anyone really suggest that riding bikes and buying organic shampoo would drive them out and win our freedom? I get that we have an emotional block. It's hard to name a perpetrator. I understand that. But they do have names and addresses. And more important, the infrastructure of industrial civilization is incredibly vulnerable, a point to which we will return. So how would a resistance movement be organized? Well, throughout history, you've got the culture of resistance that builds the new institutions that can take over and organize that better society as the old ones come down. And then you've got the combatants that are doing those direct confrontations with power. Now, I want to be clear again, when I say combatants, that does not have to mean violence. The distinction is not between violence and nonviolence. The distinction is between doing something and doing nothing, between fighting power and submitting to power. So we need lots and lots of people who can do the standard work that cultures of resistance do. Local economies that are just and sustainable, participatory democracy, systems of justice for settling disputes, character building, breaking through the denial, the accommodation, the consent, and then direct support for the frontline resistance. Okay, well, the vast majority of people are not going to resist shit, and I think we just accept that. Of those that do, it's still only a tiny number that ever take up those frontline positions. And that's true in regular armies. Only 2% of actual people in the army ever take up combat roles. The other 98% do the support. It was true in the IRA. 2% were all that ever picked up weapons. 98% did the support. And on down the line. Most people don't have the personality for it, or they can't take the risks for very legitimate reasons. And that's fine, because we do need the support roles filled. But all of this, the last 40 minutes, all of this is for you who are the 2%. You are the people I want to talk to, because we need warriors who will put themselves between what is left of this planet and fossil fuel. We need to stop industrial civilization. Now, that could be done nonviolently. If we had the numbers, we could bring this party down by midnight using human blockades. I don't see the numbers. I would love to be wrong. I would vastly prefer to wage this struggle using nonviolence, but I don't see the numbers, and my longing will not bring them forth. And it's a little late in the day for millennialism, so given a realistic assessment of what we actually have, the only viable strategy left that I can see is direct attacks on infrastructure. In the plainest terms, we need to stop them. Now, this is not a game for children, and this revolution is not for the hell of it. We need a serious underground organization that has the training, the discipline, the command structure, and the strategic savvy to coordinate decisive action on a continental scale, and we needed it yesterday. And it would be really great if the permaculture wing could get on board and provide that loyalty and material support. At the very least, they've got to stop saying that this can't be done. It can. The only real question is, why aren't we doing it? And I hate that part of the answer is, it's because we are the people who benefit from this repulsive arrangement of power. Well, not only can it be done, there are manuals that will tell you how. Now, these are written with your tax dollars. You might as well read them. Just saying. And these are basic principles of asymmetric warfare. And if there was ever an asymmetric conflict, this is it. So decentralized execution, guerrilla combat operations feature, you have centralized planning, but you have decentralized execution. So you've got to coordinate to build toward those long-range goals, your long-term objectives. So you need intelligence and planning. Well, that's kind of obvious. Surprise is about your only advantage because the enemy has all the resources. You want short-duration action. Okay, you accomplish your objective swiftly, you disappear. This is not a pitched battle. You would never win. Okay, they've got everything. So what you want is coordinated multiple attacks using surprise. And what you're ultimately after is cascading systems failure. The point is not to make a statement. The point is to make a decisive material impact. Okay, decisive material impact. In other words, you bring it down. Now, the reason you can learn about asymmetric warfare at places like West Point and the U.S. Army and training camps all around the world is because direct attacks on infrastructure is highly effective as a strategy. The principles have been honed for decades. When understood and used properly, it's highly effective. So please stop saying that it doesn't work. Now, beyond the general principles, you can also learn about target selection. I like this. Criticality, how important is this? Vulnerability, how tough is your target? Accessibility, how easy is it to get near the target? And recuperability, how much, you know, what would it take to replace this or repair it? And suddenly there's a few things that start to make sense. One reason that groups like the ELF have had no decisive success is because the targets have low criticality, high recuperability. And that is very typical for resistance groups that lack training. Targets are chosen for their accessibility. They're easy to get to. But they're not in any way critical, and they're easily repaired. And this would be your basic McDonald's window strategy. I say this as someone who has smashed her share of windows. I have personally destroyed thousands of dollars of property. It is a lot of fun, but ultimately it's pointless. Why? Low criticality, high recuperability. Smashing that window does not stop the bad people from doing their bad things for even a second. We've got to stop thinking like vandals and start thinking like field commanders. Now, we've been carrying out... Yeah. We've been carrying out operations that are emotionally appealing in the hopes that they would somehow accumulate into an effective action. I call this emotional activism, and it merges really well with that secular millennialism. This was the problem, for instance, with the Weather Underground. And increasing your firepower will not increase the soundness of your strategy. Now, you're not going to walk away from this with a serious grounding in the theory and practice of guerrilla warfare, but this is my point. Other people have figured this out. Serious people. People who intend, in fact, to win. They have a goal, a grand strategy, and after examining the resources they actually have on hand, they move on to tactics. So I'd say we have a two-part goal. Part one, to disrupt and dismantle industrial civilization, to thereby remove the ability of the rich to steal from the poor and the powerful to destroy the planet. And part two, to defend and rebuild just, sustainable, autonomous human communities as part of that to assist in the recovery of the land. These two goals are interdependent. The movements involved are going to have to work in tandem for either to be successful. And that's why I want the permaculture wing to get on board. Part two is going to involve large numbers of people in many different organizations, completely above ground. Part one could be achieved using nonviolent tactics, but we don't have the numbers, and I think we all know that. So it's going to take an underground network that's both well-trained and dead serious. And in case you can't find a way to hope, there is hope. The above ground could take its hope from the French labor strike that happened last November. The protesters used trucks, burning tires, and human blockades to stop the fuel depots, and they managed to close all 12 of France's oil refineries. The major oil terminal was offline for 3 weeks. They stranded 30 oil tankers out in the Mediterranean. When the government tried to open the country's emergency reserves, they escalated, and the protesters blockaded 20 more terminals. In a few weeks, the entire economy was grinding to a halt for lack of fuel. The French strikers did what every military and every insurgency does. They interrupted key nodes of infrastructure. They were well on their way to completely shutting down the economy, and they did it using nonviolence. So it could be done. If we had the bodies, it could be done. The question is, do we? Now that's for the above ground. For the below ground, your hope is mend. This is the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta. The oil industry has earned hundreds of billions of dollars from Nigeria's oil. Oil accounts for 40% of the country's gross domestic product. The Niger Delta is the world's largest wetland. Only now, it could more reasonably be called a sludge land. The indigenous people used to be able to support themselves. No more. They are now knee-deep in the oil industry waste. The fish have been devastated. The people are sick and starving. The original resistance was MOSAP, and this was led by the poet-activist Ken Sarawiwa. Theirs is a nonviolent campaign against Royal Dutch and Shell and the military regime. In 1995, Sarawiwa and eight others of the leaders of this movement, they were all hanged by the military, despite international outcry and despite their nonviolence. And by all accounts, Ken Saro-Wiwa was hanged last, which is to say he had to watch all his friends die first. So in case you had any questions about the sadism of the people that we are fighting, there it is. Now, MEND is the second generation resistance. They do direct attacks against infrastructure. The bridges, office sites, storage facilities, rigs, pipelines, and the support vessels. They have reduced Nigeria's oil output by a third. Yeah. In one single attack, they were able to stop 10% of the oil. And in a series of attacks last December, over about a week, right before Christmas, they stopped 80% of the oil in 1 week. Their main tactic is the use of speedboats in surprise attacks against simultaneous targets toward that goal of cascading systems failure. These people are quite serious. They're very sophisticated. They have university educations. They've studied other militant movements. Their training in combat is so good that they have fought and won in skirmishes against both Nigeria's elite fighting forces and Shell's private military. Oh, did you know? Oil companies have their own private militaries? Yeah. I don't know where people in the United States think oil comes from. Like, you can't grow it in the backyard. It doesn't fall from the sky like the rain. It has to be ripped out of the land. And that means that people have to be ripped off their land. And that means those people have to be ripped in half. And that would be called a private military. So MEND has the broad sympathy of the Niger Delta community, and that's a quote. This sympathy has helped them maintain security because people take them in, they don't turn them in. These are not armed thugs, this is a true resistance movement. And they number just a few hundred. So understand, a few hundred people, well trained and organized, have reduced the oil output of Nigeria by a third. MEND has said to the oil industry, it must be clear that the Nigerian government cannot protect your workers or assets. Leave our land while you can or die in it. I can guarantee that everyone in this room has more resources than everyone in MEND put together when they started. Resistance is not just theoretically possible. It's happening now. The question is, are we going to join them? What if we said, leave our land or you will die in it? What if we meant it? Okay, the facts as they stand. Our planet is dying. Actually, she's being drawn and quartered. We are on the verge of complete biotic collapse. There are parts of China where there are no longer any flowering plants. No flowering plants. It's because the pollinators are all dead. And that is 500 million years of evolution gone. Complete biotic collapse. We are out of soil, we are out of species, and we are out of time. And catastrophic climate change has already begun. We really need to start thinking like a serious resistance movement because this is a war. I know it's been going on 10,000 years. It feels like daily life. The lights are on, the cupboards are full, but this is a war. And if anyone is left to look back 100 years from now, they are going to wonder, what the fuck was wrong with us that we didn't fight like hell when our planet was going down? Now, you love something or you wouldn't be here. Whatever you love, it is under assault. Love is a verb. We've got to let that love call us to action. Thank you.